Oh my gosh, I can't believe we're here. I'm so excited and thrilled to be here. Thank you, White House, for letting us record this episode of our podcast from the White House.
Thank you, President Hussein Barack Obama.
And you're hearing laughter because we have our family here to join us. We have lots of members of our family. Well, not that many members, but we have a handful of people. So thank you for y'all to be joining us in this room. What room are we in?
Cordell Hull.
We're in the Cordell Hull.
We're in the Cordell Hull.
Where they make declarations of war.
Do they now?
I don't know. Is that true? Oh, no, that's not true.
Well, this is an important room, so we're excited to be in the room for sure.
Creeping Sharia. We have all our segments. We have our theme song. Like, I can't believe that we're in this space
right now. I'm actually pretty stunned to be on the microphone right now and looking at the Washington Monument. So the reason why we're here is...
because of you.
Because of me.
Because Taz knows everyone, and it is clear to me now that she is a member of the Illuminati.
I'm not a member of the Illuminati. I got an award. That's why I'm here. We got the Champion of Change. There was about 10 people that got awarded the Champion of Change Award, and I am one of them.
Taz, you got an award from the White House, and now we're doing a podcast here.
Yeah.
You're almost president.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, if I can get the access to Air Force One now, that'd be the best.
Better than Southwest.
Better than Southwest.
Oh. Inshallah. Allahu Akbar. We have like a whole list of words and phrases we've wanted to say. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Salawat. Allahumma sal ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Ya Hussein. He's a Shia. He's mine.
Yeah. Okay, the first thing I want to talk about is the word inshallah.
Inshallah, we will talk about inshallah.
Inshallah, we will talk about inshallah. And how we can't say the word on airplanes anymore. So there was this case that happened last month, where Khairuddin Mazumi, an Iraqi immigrant, was asked to speak at the UN. And then on his flight back to UC Berkeley, he's a UC Berkeley student, he's 26 years old, he was booted from a Southwest flight and questioned by the FBI because some person on the plane heard him say, inshallah. So now, like, inshallah is like this terrible, scary term, but it's so ridiculous because we were in the book, Love Inshallah, and inshallah is one of the most beautiful words that, to me, that really resonates so much that isn't captured by the English language.
Also, if you grew up Muslim, you know that inshallah also means it won't happen.
Let's say more about that.
Mom, are we going to celebrate Christmas? Inshallah, well. Mom, can I have this cool pound puppy? I want it. Inshallah, I'll get it for you. Inshallah, inshallah.
I'm looking at your mom for verification there. Did that mean you didn't do any of this for her?
If God willing, right?
My mom just said, if God willing.
Which technically is the correct definition of what
I'm just saying for flight attendants everywhere, if a terrorist is sitting in the front row and you hear him say, inshallah, it will happen, it's not gonna happen.
There you go.
It means plans canceled.
And the thing is, this isn't just one case. I feel like we've had one case a week happening where someone's getting kicked off the plane. Last time, in our last South by Southwest episode, it was the because an auntie stared wrong. Now it's for the word inshallah. And it's just constantly there's something going on.
I'm waiting for my first class ticket.
I think they should give every single Muslim a first class. Oh, Southwest doesn't have first class tickets.
I was just going to say, you know, they could just send us like a certificate. Because they don't actually have first class.
Right.
So they could be like, you are a first class seat for
You mean
this.
They should just have like the seats reserved for Muslims in the front? Inshallah.
Is it? Are we okay with it if it's in the front?
I don't know. Where's the safest place to be on a plane?
Next to the Muslim. What? I get the newsletter.
Oh.
There's no newsletter. I thought you were going to go with me on that joke, but instead I just sound like a terrorist. It's fine. I'm at the White House. I'm at the White House. Okay, so segue. At San Diego State University, some posters went up that basically implicated a couple of students as being terrorists.
That's terrible.
And actually call them terrorists.
On a college campus.
Yeah.
But of course the administration stepped in and helped out, right?
Not exactly.
What did they do?
Well, it took an entire student body of Muslim students and maybe some allies they actually staged, instead of a sit-in, a prayer in. And all started praying around the president of San Diego State University. They all started praying around his car so that he couldn't leave campus until he apologized.
I love that.
It was so powerful.
Yeah.
There were cop cars, there was the president's car, and they just kept praying. I mean, they're sitting there in front of a car and police.
So speaking of protests and cops and all things bad, a woman in Long Beach was pulled over by cops and forced to take off her hijab on May 5th in Long Beach.
By police?
By police.
You know, there was only one time I think that being Muslim actually helped me out with the cops. I just remembered this.
All right.
Okay, so I'm driving home like really late. This was back before I didn't drink. Sorry, Mom. And I was like, I think it was like 20 years old, uh-huh. And I was driving home, and it was like 2 a.m, which is like high time to like find people who are drunk drivers, right? To catch drunk drivers. And this cop pulls me over, and I was like, I swerved because I was like trying to pick something up. And so he pulled me over and he was like, all right, have you been drinking tonight? And I said, no. And he said, where are you coming from? And I said, a friend's house. And he said, oh, party? No. And he just kept asking me all these questions. And then I said, listen, I'm Muslim. If I was drinking, I would be much more worried about hell than you, sir. And then he just stopped and he goes, hell, huh? Wow. I'm Presbyterian, but my wife's Episcopalian. I don't think you should go to hell. But I'm glad you're not doing it. Good job. And that's it. He let me go.
Wow. Wow. I'm going to try that next time.
If you're drunk, you could try that too.
Yeah. Taz. Oh, wait. No, we have it. Oh, no, you're going first. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I am going first.
Yeah.
This is awkward.
I'm introducing the Awkward Ask a Muslim segment, and I've got the first one.
What is it?
Okay, so I rarely wear dresses.
Yeah.
And I wore 2 dresses in the same day yesterday.
Oh, right, because we had the awards ceremony and then we had the gala afterwards.
Where the president was and Aziz Ansari.
What?
That happened. Okay, so I did not realize that we had to be there by 1:15. I thought we had to be there by 2. So at like 1, I text Taz and I'm like, hey, so I'm gonna go get my nails done. When do we need to be there? And then she wrote 1:15. And that is when I threw down everything I was doing and immediately shaved my legs in the sink and filed my nails down so that no one could notice I didn't have my manicure done and bolted. And as I'm running out, like I'm really self-conscious in dresses because they're like really, especially the dress I was wearing was like form-fitting, and I grew up with the whole like, don't show off your body, don't show off your curves, and I'm a curvy lady. And it's a short skirt, and I still, like, do you get this where like if I wear a skirt and my legs are showing or like my sleeves are showing, my arms are showing, like I still get a little bit.
Oh, totally.
So I'm running out, and these two guys are totally staring at my legs. And I was like, ew, pervs, gross.
Yeah.
This is why Islam says cloak this, so that I don't have the male gaze on me all the time, jerks. And then I get in the cab, and I look down, and my legs are just, like, bleeding.
Oh, God.
Because I had nicked myself shaving, and there was blood dripping down my legs.
How much blood?
I mean, that's the thing, is water helps it spread. It probably also didn't help that I, like, totally snubbed them and was like, excuse me, and I have to get to the White House.
You said that to these guys that were staring at your legs?
No, but I said that to the guy who was calling for cab drivers, uh-huh, so that they would hear, like, excuse me. And I was like, I also was like in a hurry. So I'm just like trying to imagine what these guys saw was like this girl running up the stairs with like blood streaming down.
That's so funny.
Her legs. And then being like, ugh, annoying guys after sharing their genuine concern. And then hopping into a cab and being like, to the White House! Awkward.
Awkward. So my awkward Ask a Muslim happened in Sacramento. I flew up to do an election training for Muslim Lobby Day. There were 600 Muslims that showed up in Sacramento. They were lobbying various bills, such as anti-bullying bills, and that's the only one I can remember right now. I'll just say they were lobbying various bills having to affect the Muslim community. And I had to do this training in this tent that was outside the Capitol building. So it was on the lawn, and it was this big white tent, and we had the projector set up, and we had a PowerPoint set up, and I was, you know, going through campaign basics training. And I'm doing this training, and I finally get to the end, and I'm doing this Q&A section where I'm taking in questions from people who have questions about, you know, how do I run a campaign? And then out of the corner of my eye, I see this rando white guy in military garb, like camo, and he had a dog around his neck. Like, he was holding the dog, so like the dog's front legs was down one side of his shoulder and the other back legs were down the other side. And he just kind of like wanders into the tent to see if, like, I think, to see if I would get scared that there was a dog, right? Because I'm a Muslim and Muslims are supposed to be scared of dogs. And I think this guy was literally just wandering around anytime he saw Muslims in front of the Capitol, trying to make them feel uncomfortable with dogs, which is so silly. Cause I mean, like, I don't hate dogs, but like, I'm like, you know, like I'm not gonna like run in the other direction. It's not like Muslims are gonna be like, oh my God, it's a dog, run. Like, that's not gonna happen. Like, Muslims don't get that scared by dogs.
I mean, well, some of my Muslim friends do.
Maybe, but I just think as far as like a rebel act, like I just kind of ignored him when he came in. But it was just one of those things where afterwards, like after the training, and I was just like, went back into my memory and I was like, oh yeah, that just happened. How fucked up is that? That is so ridiculous.
That's pretty gross.
Yeah, it was gross. And there was another incident that I saw earlier in the day where this older white man had a video camera going, and he was just going around recording every single Muslim person that he saw who was on the steps. And it's kind of one of those things where it's frightening that there are these right-wing crazies who want to bring dogs and want to film anytime they see Muslims because, you know, that's what they do. But it was also so empowering to be there to see 600 Muslims. They're taking the Capitol, and they're expressing their civic engagement, and they're taking their political power back. They're saying, we are Muslim, we are American, we're here at the Capitol, and we are going to practice our civic duty and civic engagement. And we're not just going to vote, we're going to do advocacy, and we're going to lobby, and we're going to make sure that the bills that are important to us are going to be enacted. And I think that's so important that that was happening. But, you know, in this era, you have to put up with these older white men with cameras who are gonna film you. It was so creepy too, because he was older, and most of the people that were lobbying were these younger teenagers. I'm just like, that's creepy. Like, come on, this is disgusting. You are filming teenagers because you're so freaking scared. Like, get over it.
Wow.
Yeah, that was my awkward ask Muslim. I mean, there was no technical ask there, but, you know, it was still awkward all the same.
Ugh. I have no response to that.
I know.
That is the, I mean, but that is the awkward ask a Muslim, like, ugh.
Yeah.
I guess we should have that sound effect.
Mm. Ugh. So we are welcoming to the microphone Asra Najam and Manar Wahid. Thank you so much for allowing us to record here. I mean, definitely thank you for giving us access to the space.
Thank you for the work you're doing. Let's just do thank yous.
But yeah, we'll just do
and
round thank yous.
And it's the people's house. So.
The people's house. Yes, house this is too. The people's house. Rephrase.
The people's house.
The people's house.
We're just gonna sit here beaming.
So you're both Muslim, you're working in the White House. What's that experience been like?
Wait, what?
This is like the one place actually that I've ever worked where people have not asked me questions about my faith or like try to get me to be the Muslim person on staff. I've worked at a lot of other places before I came here. And I'm generally, like, I find that people ask those questions a lot, ask about fasting a lot, ask about drinking a lot. But this is the one place where I've actually chosen to identify as Muslim and then been able to do work in that space because I want to.
And I know one of the things that you worked on was the mosque visit that the president just did. That just happened a couple months ago, right?
Yeah. I didn't really do it. I just kind of worked on it with like a billion other people.
Yeah. So what was that? what happened? What?
I mean, I think it's something that had been on the radar for a while. I mean, the Muslim community had definitely been asking for that to happen. But I think the moment we were in then was just one that was so, it was such a trying moment for Muslim communities, and it felt so important for it to happen. And the truth is, a lot of people here really wanted it to happen at very, very senior levels, mm-hmm. and the president was one of them.
Was this the first president to ever go to a mosque?
Well, I'm not a historian.
Where's the legal guy?
No.
The answer is no. Not the first time.
Yeah.
What's one of your favorite stories from working at the White House?
So it's kind of an embarrassing story, and I actually tell it a lot. But so I started here right, like just months before we decided to move forward on our executive actions on immigration. So like my first time that I got to sit in a meeting with the president was like very shortly after we announced. And there were all these advocates in the room, and it was in the Roosevelt room. So it was a big table like this, maybe a little bit smaller, and I was actually sitting kind of on the back benches behind him, and he got up to leave. And you stand, when the president stands, you stand. So I stood up and he turned around and I almost ran into him. There was a seat behind me, there was nowhere to go. My boss sometimes refers to that as the time that I tried to tackle the president. I did not, I love him so much.
I really want to ask, where were you when you found out Obama was elected? What were you doing?
I'm very young, and I guess I'm about to reveal this right now. So I was in high school when the president was elected, and so I remember sort of sitting on my couch and watching the news coverage up until very late.
So you couldn't even vote for him?
I couldn't even vote. Oh my God.
Me too, Tess. Remember when we were in high school?
Oh yeah, me too. I could not vote for him.
I was in junior high.
But I remember like my bedtime was super early, but I stayed up. And it was a self-imposed bedtime. It wasn't like my parents were making me
I was just going to say you had a bedtime in high school.
I mean, you have to wake up at like 5 something in the morning to go to school. But I remember sort of staying up as late as I could stretch myself to, and just, I mean, I never would have imagined that, you know, just a few years later, I'd be working for this president. And so it's just been an incredible journey to be here, and I'm very fortunate that I am here.
my favorite one? Mm-hmm. Taz.
Dude, we're so doing the ultimate creeping right now.
This is the ultimate creeping Sharia.
We're in the White House. Just want to say, just want to put that out there.
We are the White House. My creeping Sharia is like, it's kind of like, oh, cringe, but also cringe.
Yeah.
Which is like our episodes. But studies show that toddlers kill more people than Muslims by exactly 50%. Unpacking this. Muslims pinned against toddlers.
Are toddlers apologizing for other toddlers? Because that's what I need to know.
You know what?
Where are the toddlers apologizing?
All I can tell you is, at least they are in playpens behind walls. And there's also this article talks about how in these states, some of them do have really strict gun laws and some of them don't. There's not really like any consistency there. The one thing that is consistent though is that there is really no eye on gun control like there is on Muslims committing acts of violence.
Yeah.
I love the way the article concludes. It says, if anything good should come of this, it's a lesson we can learn from how we've responded to the toddler shooting crisis compared to how we've treated Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Don't criminalize an entire demographic based on the actions of a small few. Just the idea of criminalizing toddlers.
They should be locked up. Send them all out of this country right now. Send them back to where they came from. Mine, creeping Sharia, is going to yogurt, Chobani, Greek yogurt, which was kind of funny because the guy that owns Greek yogurt is Muslim. So Chobani is like the most popular yogurt out there. I don't know if it's most popular, but it's pretty.
Don't out the man.
No, I'm totally outing him. He's his name is Hamdi Ulukaya. He's Muslim and the CEO and founder of this Greek yogurt, Chobani. They're going public, and he told the company's 2,000 full-time employees at its upstate New York plant that they're going to receive shares worth up to 10% of the company's value when it goes public. And some workers could, you know, it could come out to almost $1 million, which, damn, that was generous.
Dude, Chobani yogurt.
That's wild.
Like, the collection of interviews that we have is pretty baller right now.
Yeah.
For our first episode with interviews.
Yay.
Champions of Change, welcome and congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations.
Kehan Irani and Fazia Mirza are joining us today. Mm-hmm. Please tell us a little bit about the work that you do. Tell our listeners.
My name is Fazia Mirza, and I am an actor and a writer and a producer, and I do some comedy. And as an artist, my mission is to break down stereotypes across race and gender and religion and sexual orientation, using comedy as a tool to do it. And you know it's comedy when you use that voice. When you talk like this, you're being funny.
Zara have that voice quite a bit. That all makes sense now.
That's the way of my tricks.
I'm sorry. I gotta go. Bye. I make short films and web series, and I'm making my first feature. And I've written plays, I've performed plays, and I'm very excited to be here. Within the White House and with the Muslims.
The Muslims Woo-hoo! In the White House.
The Muslims in the White House. I feel like that could be a hashtag for this whole
podcast. It is. Done.
Muslims in the White House. Also, I just want to say one phrase that I thought I would like to add to phrases said in the White House. Moist panties.
I feel like, wait, where's our historic?
That was me slow clapping.
Can we get our fact checker to verify? The Kennedys, though. No comment. No comment was his response.
I'm Kehan Irani, and I'm also an actor, a performer, a writer, producer, using theater storytelling to get people engaged in analyzing their problems, looking at their own lives, and coming up with solutions. So I also produce art, but I also lead communities and lead people in creating art and stories through Theater of the Oppressed and through participatory theater and narrative strategies and methodologies.
Can you tell us a little bit about Theater of the Oppressed?
there's a lot to tell, but a short synopsis, created in Brazil around the 50s through the 70s by a man named Augusto Boal, who is a student of Paulo Freire, who created Pedagogy of the Oppressed. It was a methodology to teach illiterate Brazilians who were landless peasants to read and write, but it was a political methodology, so you were reading, he said, he doesn't want you to just read the word, he wants you to read the world. And so it was a way of using literacy education or adult education to politicize and get people active in analyzing what were the social conditions they were living in and why does it persist. And so Boal took these methodologies and brought them into the theater and said theater is a human language, it's a language that we all have access to from children to adults, and how can we use the tools of the theater for people to start thinking about what's the situation, what are the conditions in which they live, and how can they change it?
Hmm. So how do you bring this into your work now?
So I bring into my work by training people in the methodologies. I lead monthly workshops with one of the oldest Theater of the Oppressed training groups in New York City called Top Lab, Theater of the Oppressed Laboratory. We've been there for 25 years, but I haven't been with them for all 25. And Boal would come annually to New York and lead workshops and collaborate with us. And then I create community-based projects. So I create projects for communities to engage with using narrative, what I call narrative strategy, storytelling forms, to be able to build community, again, analyze the issues that they face, and then think about creative strategies to counter, what's coming at them.
And you have a project with Muslim women in New York right now, right?
Yeah, well, it just finished. It was called the Muslim Women's Story Lab, and it was using narrative storytelling to build community, to get women to look at women's perspective on Islamophobia, Muslim women's leadership and what gets in the way, and also women and mosque equity. And this was in partnership with a community-based organization called Women in Islam. It was just an honor to be able to facilitate that group as a non-Muslim and be able to make space and hold space for women to really authentically share the multiplicity of their humanity as Muslim women as it comes at them internally from the community, internally from their family, but also externally from people outside, people who are ignorant about what Islam is and who Muslim women are in the world. And so it's like, how is that humanity affected by various forms of oppression and how it comes at them?
Well, I'm especially excited that both of you are in theater. That's one of the things I love about the both of you is that you don't just stick to the script, you know, and in the larger sense as well, that like we can't stick to the script. And I remember tweeting one of your quotes from the speeches yesterday, but now I'm gonna butcher it. Don't wait for people to cast you. And here we are, three women with one woman shows, right?
Should we just do them?
Can I have a one woman show too?
You are a one woman show.
You're doing it right now.
Okay.
Don't add to the competition test.
We all thought we were the first.
There's a likeness that hit so close to home.
Wait, there's another person? God, the internet really brought us together.
And the number of tags and articles written about me so that I'm the only one. Like, is she the only feminist Muslim Iranian who lives in the Bay Area? Who drives a Honda? Who lives in Oakland and travels to San Francisco? Who likes Gouda? She's the only one. She's the only one.
So, congratulations, you all got the Champion of Change, as did I.
Congratulations to you.
What was the experience like for you?
It was surreal. I was, trying to hold on and feel like I was in control, but I was just so pleased that my parents could be there. And that, my dad could call all the relatives and tell them I was meeting Obama. It was so nice to have, all the relatives watch the live stream and them feel so proud. And if I can make them proud of me, then, I don't need to have a child.
Isn't that what we're all trying to do?
Yes, basically.
How can I strategize my life? What do I have to do so I don't have to have a baby? So I agree. I'm working on that. But my line's like how not to be with a man and not to have a baby. Like those are the two goals. So the White House is helping with all of that.
Thank you, White House.
Thank you, White House, for helping my identity. You know, it is exciting. I mean, these are the things, right? We come from these Asian families and these immigrant families, and these things matter. So every time you accomplish something, and it's kind of ironic, we are these like overachieving Asians who are like, no, I'm totally going into the arts, I'm doing something different. But yet, in order to please our parents, we're still overachieving.
Right.
Like it takes the White House for mom to be like, my baby, she's going to the White House. I'm like, mom, I'm gonna talk about gay things. Well, I didn't say that actually, she freaked out. But you know what I mean? Like that's I mean, it does matter and it does help.
I also want to recognize the three of you here, Taz, Kehan, Fazia, three women in multiple disciplines, mm-hmm. not just one. And it's not because you're inefficient or distracted or can't choose, or disorganized, or going through a phase, or don't know what you want to do with your life.
Okay.
This is the work that you do, and it's multifaceted. I kind of wanted to hear you guys sort of talk a little bit about what inspires you to go into one medium rather than another, or what takes you out of a medium for a while.
I think a lot of what I do is kind of using arts as a strategy, so looking at how are we changing something, and so what's the most useful medium to tell that story and get people engaged around it. And if it happens to be theater, it's theater. If it happens to be TV, it's TV. I'm committed to being an artist and bringing voices that are on the margins into the center, but I'm also committed to bringing arts and creativity and the tools and methodologies into non-arts fields. So a lot of my work has been collaborating with NGOs or with government agencies to use artistic and creative practices so they can do their work better. And that's just what I believe in. I believe in a society where arts and, you know, creativity is held central to human liberation and human development. And it's not going to happen if I only work in the theater, if I only work in one medium. I have to show people what's possible.
Okay, well, that was a great answer, so I mean, I don't know if anybody else should say anything, so we should end it.
Well, you also do, you're also involved in film, you're also involved in...
No, I mean, I don't know, like, the reason I feel like there was a time where I would sit there and be like, is this idea stand-up comedy, is it a web series, is it a sketch, is it a movie, you know, and I think that I'm at the point now where there's just a feel of what feels right. And there's things I think that you can make quicker, and there's things that you can't. So, you know, something like the one-woman show for me was something. I mean, look, there's four of us with, you know, microphones, and three of us have one-woman shows, and you.
I have one too.
You have one too.
It's in my head.
Poetry that made my girlfriend cry. You know, and it's very moving. And you know, it's. I felt like that was important as a means of like telling stories that way, but don't worry, I'm going to turn it into a movie. But I don't know, I think it's just a matter of the right feeling and who can access it. You know, I think what's really fun about like the digital space is now we can, you know, after having been to Pakistan, I mean, I don't know about you, but all these like young Pakistani boys and girls, like, and older Pakistani boys and girls, they liked my page. So now I have all these like Pakistani people who continue to watch and see what I'm doing, and that's kind of awesome. So there's content that they can consume that's digital that they couldn't consume if it were, you know, a piece of theater in the same way. So that's really fun and exciting for me.
So it really changes the access.
Really change. Yeah, I think access is crazy. So, you know, sometimes that's the point. Yeah. What about you?
Taz?
So I'm a poet, writer, and now podcaster, but I also do painting. Mm-hmm. I paint. So for me, painting and poetry, I turn to when I get stuck with my written words. And I think only recently have I really been thinking about, okay, if I'm going to be pushing for particular policy issues or activist issues, you know, how am I going to approach it? And I think it does go with your gut instinct, like what are you feeling? But also I think it's important that different people intake art differently. And if you're gonna get a message across, they're not only going to just take it in with one way. You can move people through different multidisciplinary, is that a word? Mm-hmm. They can take it in through painting, through visual, through written, through audio, through whatever, and you just need to hit people with different messages in different ways to move them. So that's been something that I've been consciously been doing for the past 3-4 years. But I think before I was like, oh, I'm a writer. Oh no, I'm a poet. Oh, I don't know. I was conflicted. Now I'm just like, I am me, and I do lots of things, and I'm okay with that.
I think there's more space for that too now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels as though whether it's the internet or whatever, you know, like that's created a space where you can do that, where, you know, like a YouTube star wasn't sitting there being like, I'm going to be an actor. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were just like, I have this thing I can make. You know, I know how to make really cool crafts out of garbage, you know?
Yeah.
That's something I'm going to show people how to do. And then suddenly, you know, they're an artist or they're an educator or they're a TV personality, you know? So I don't know.
Can I ask my question?
Please.
So we asked you to bring in awkward Ask a Muslim moment. Mm. Do you have one?
Well, the one I remembered was years ago. I was temping as a receptionist in different firms, and I remember being at this very fancy private equity firm, very boutique, very rich, and I was just the receptionist, and I was talking to this white lady who happened to have come in for an appointment. And I don't know, I was just chatting, we had gotten on the subject of whatever, and I was like, oh yeah, I do this, and I do that, and I do babysitting, and I do things. And she's like, oh, do you have your papers?
No.
Papers?
Come on.
Maybe she meant origami.
I wish it was pretty. I wanted to be like...
rolling a cigarette.
I'd like a blunt. Do you have some paper?
Yeah, no. I mean, I really, like, in that moment, I was like, where the fuck do you think you are? Like, you're sitting in, you know, I'm the receptionist in this boutique, fancy, super, like, the firm had their own freaking private jet. I mean, I was working, I was like, where the fuck are you? Like, that you're going to ask me for my papers, but I was just like, yeah. And then I just, like, awkwardly changed the subject or went back to doing what I was doing, because I was just so shocked, you know, I never heard it, I couldn't believe that she was asking me that.
And also what a really like archaic way of asking.
Yeah.
Yeah, like World War II style. Where are your papers?
Did she sound like that? Was there a time machine nearby?
And then she disappeared and I was alone. So, I mean, it's not microaggression, it's pretty macro, but...
That was definitely an awkward ask, though.
Yeah,
so yeah.
Why?
What would you say now if you could go back?
I wouldn't answer her. Mm. I'd probably be like, and then, just type on my computer or like a tweet or something like this.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this interview. That was amazing. In the White House.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for, and congratulations on your award.
Congratulations.
To you too.
And thank you for your work.
Okay. Thank you for your work.
Bye.
Yeah. Bye.
Well, actually, I have a question for you before we end. Okay. Because, Taz, I am curious for you. You call yourself a radical. You do radical work.
Mm-hmm.
How is it for you to be here?
Oh, calling my...
Yeah, I mean, we're coming to a close now. We're about to leave.
The White House.
I kind of don't want to.
Yeah, I think I'm going to just hide under this table.
If we keep talking, does it mean that, like, just we have to keep podcasting? Like, I could just filibuster, like... to stay.
Good use of filibuster. Okay, so what does it feel like to be in the White House as a political organizer and an activist?
And critic.
Wow, it's been really interesting. I think, you know, one of the things I always talk about in my trainings is how politicians will listen to two things. They'll either listen to money, such as people who will donate to get them into office, or they'll listen to votes, people who elect to keep them in power. And I never had money, so I've been working to get people to vote and get, you know, and express their action through that. And I think a big part of closing the loop when it comes to civic engagement is that you're not just getting people to vote, but you're holding your electeds accountable. And I think a lot of what's been going on for me since I went to Vegas to go campaign for Obama in 2008 is to hold him accountable in some ways and hold his administration accountable and hold Congress accountable to the Muslim community and the needs in our community and how we need laws to protect us. So it's been really interesting to be an organizer and then boom, like 8 years later, getting an award from the White House for that. That's just so surreal, because I think it's kind of like a full circle to be here after 8 years. Like, that's amazing. I just hope we don't have to take a step back with the next presidency.
Well, I'm not listening to that. That's a bunch of radical bullshit.
Radical bullshit, another phrase we've always wanted to say in the White House. Do we have to end this?
Filibuster. I think we found the title of the podcast.
Filibuster. Oh, so.
Filibuster of the Zara, podcast. Like, it's your last chance. What are you going to say? This is it.
What do you want to say?
Thanks. Thanks for letting me be here. I can't believe we're here. Oh my God, this room is beautiful. I wish you could see it, and you can't, and you're so envious of me right now.
Good Muslim, bad Muslim is in the White House. I just want to say that over and over and over again.
A special thanks goes out to President Barack Hussein Obama and the White House administration for support on this episode. And Taz.
Thanks for listening to the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast, hosted by Taz Ahmed and Zara Nurbash. You can follow me on Twitter at TazzyStar, that's TazzyStar, and Zara at Zara Comedy, that's ZAHRA Comedy. This episode is produced by Anna Alderstein, sound engineered by Mickey Kapper, and assistance by our producer, Quincy Sura-Smith. You can find us on the web at goodmuslimbadmuslim.com. To follow the conversation, use the hashtag GoodMuslimBadMuslim.
Allahu Akbar.